The Virtual Curbside is a production of the Utah Chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics, the Utah AAP, working together to improve children's lives through education, advocacy, and networking. Hi, this is Paul Workus from the Utah AAP. Welcome to this week's edition of the Virtual Curbside, where we bring pediatric providers together with subspecialists to get smarter about all things pediatric and better acquainted as a community of caregivers. Welcome back to the Virtual Curbside. This is our monthly episode 4, where we get to ask our speaker all the questions that we've gotten from our episodes for the month so far. And by the way, thanks for all your questions and feedback. The Virtual Curbside is brought to you in part by a generous grant from Primary Children's Hospital. Primary Children's Hospital, the child, first and always. Welcome back to the Virtual Curbside. This is the curbside part where you get to ask questions, and we are very fortunate to have Jake Robson back with us answer your questions. How you doing?
I'm great. Thanks for having me back. I'm excited to hear what the audience wants to hear more about.
Well, I've heard nice things about the episodes we recorded together. Lots of surprises, I think, in that. I don't think that any of us are really quite prepared for what a big deal this is. And I think it's been very illuminating. And as you would know, offline, I've actually referred a patient to you in the last week or so based on stuff that you taught me. So nice work.
Thank you. Yeah, I said earlier today in clinic, it's the most common disease you've never heard of. And so that always makes people feel a little bit better that they have a common disease that we're comfortable taking care of, even if it hasn't totally hit the mainstream press yet.
Right. Yeah. Well, we'll see what we can do to move it up the heat map. Before we start, is there anything you want to disclose?
Yes, I'll remind the audience that I participate in the Speakers Bureau for the medication called Dupixent. And that's my only disclosure.
Okay. Do you have a verified Twitter account?
I don't know what it takes to be verified, but I do have a Twitter account. I think it is GI_Jake_PCH. When I was a fellow, people used to make fun of me and say, hey, let's call GI Jake and get him involved.
That's pretty good.
Yeah, and I didn't know they were making fun of me. I thought they thought I was really cool.
They did.
Yeah. And then I realized they were making fun of me because I took GI problems so seriously and I was right there to help out.
I think you're misunderstanding their sincere regard for you.
Perhaps.
Ready?
Yes.
So after talking to you and your colleagues, I think you've got us all nervous. Are there any patients that I should feel comfortable treating for GERD related esophagitis? And where do I draw the line?
Yeah. So I think none of us have an issue with a, you know, brief time-limited course of antacid therapy to see if a child who's having reflux-related complaints, however they describe it, whether it's heartburn or, you know, that sensation of food coming back up into their throat or just kind of discomfort in their, you know, upper stomach chest region with eating, I'd have no problem with a short course of, you know, typically we recommend Pepcid or Pepcid Complete, or even a short prescription course of a PPI, especially if this is a relatively new onset problem and we're sort of trying to see if this is going to become a thing or not. Where I draw the line is when, you know, a patient found themselves on omeprazole and they are asking for a second, third, and fourth refill because it's really working. And when they miss a day or two or, you know, just can't seem to come off it, I would say that's where I sort of draw the line, whether it's GERD-related esophagitis or EoE or some other problem. Needing a prolonged course of a PPI in a younger child is something I feel is pretty abnormal and should be evaluated further. Certainly, you know, there are certain conditions that we know, you know, may have increased reflux, things like obesity or certain, you know, developmental delays with hypotonia. But I think just since the pendulum has really swung on PPI known risks, especially in younger kids, it's something that we want to, you know, really be thoughtful about long-term use.
Very helpful. So this is sort of a companion question. Are there conditions where I should order either a swallow study or upper GI for one of my patients? It seems like we treat GERD empirically, if at all, and things like EoE need direct visualizations. So where are the situations that I should get radiography?
That's a great question, and something we actually had this discussion in clinic today about the sort of pre-endoscopy utility of imaging. So we talk about this a lot, that swallow study, or what, at least at Primary Children's, what we commonly refer to as a modified barium swallow study. It's a very specific study with a, you know, a speech pathologist, a radiologist, and they're really just taking focused pictures to look whether or not the child is having any aspiration or deep penetration towards the vocal cords. I order that occasionally if it's really unclear to me if the child is struggling with the swallow mechanism. You know, usually in older kids, we can be clear that they're having no problem with the swallow. It's once they swallow that things pass slowly or get stuck. So I order swallow study when there's concern for aspiration. If a child's having recurrent pneumonia, is not gaining weight. We just picked up an elusive H-type TEF, tracheoesophageal fistula, in the hospital last weekend, which was really neat. As far as upper GI series, you know, sometimes we'll divide it into an esophagram, which is where they're just taking fluoroscopy pictures of the esophagus as a child is swallowing some barium. Sometimes they'll even like dip a cracker in barium and watch them eat that, or a full upper GI series where they're going esophagus, stomach, duodenum to the ligament of Treitz. I will be honest, I don't order those very often in patients that have kind of characteristic symptoms of EoE. I sometimes order them in toddlers where I'm wondering if there's something stuck in there. I think that's a population that just, if it's a relatively new onset vomiting or dysphagia, you know, making sure that they don't have a foreign body is always important. I think those of us with kids are very quick to do that. And those of us that don't have kids just don't realize how much mischief they can get up to when not monitored 24/7. So I, long answer, that I don't order imaging very often prior to endoscopy. I think in the setting of foreign body, concern for anatomic abnormality, like an atresia or a malrotation in a kid that is having persistent vomiting or, you know, doesn't have other characteristics of EoE, that kind of Caucasian male with other ATP, with a family history, with characteristic symptoms. If those aren't on the table, then I think considering imaging makes sense.
Okay, very helpful. Is there a corollary for the hygiene hypothesis for why there's an increase in incidence of eosinophilic esophagitis?
For sure. Yes. The hard yes. I think we're seeing more, you know, EoE is sort of the perfect storm in the sense that, as we talked about previously, it is, in my opinion, kind of more of a delayed type hypersensitivity, sort of more of an autoimmune type disease. And certainly autoimmune disease on the rise, right? We're seeing more celiac, more Crohn's, more colitis, presumably due to early antibiotics, you know, highly processed foods, lack of exposure to antigens at a very early age. I can't imagine, you know, kind of what we may see in the next 20 years as fallout from lack of exposure in those first couple of years of kids that just stayed home for 2 years in the setting of the COVID pandemic. That'll be fascinating to watch. You know, I mean, EoE is also kind of lumped in with other atopic conditions, or at least conditions with an atopic, like kind of antigen driven focus, things like eczema, eosinophilic asthma, and those are on the rise as well. So whether you kind of look at this through an autoimmune lens or through an increase in allergic reactions, since EoE has its feet in both worlds, I think that's a decent explanation for why we're seeing so much more of it. We look a lot more too. I think we're doing, at Primary Children's Hospital, we're doing somewhere between 2,000 and 3,000 upper endoscopies a year. And Ooh. So, yeah, it's a lot. It wowed me the first time I looked, and it's going up quickly. I mean, it was between 1,000 and 2,000 10 to 15 years ago, and now we're something around 2,000 to 3,000. So we're getting asked to do this a lot. And I think for the most part, picking up this diagnosis early in kids and getting them treated has been really, really a good thing.
Sure, sure. No, that's very interesting. And the take-home message is not all germs are our enemies.
For sure. Yes, I think the good old days of putting your kid in the dirt and letting them get down and dirty still can be a really good thing.
Your organ system houses a lot of our favorite germs.
Yes.
All right.
And foreign bodies, yeah.
Question number four. Food refusal is one of the findings that should suggest the possibility of EoE. Given that this is one of the most common and multifactorial complaints we hear from families, is there a particular kind of food refusal that should be most suggestive of EoE?
This is such a good question. You know, for clinicians and then also for those of us that are parents, because I think we all really struggle to draw the line and to know sort of how to handle those battles of toddler, early elementary school age kids where we're, you know, trying to be good parents and good clinicians and really expand diet diversity and get kids to eat what we want them to eat. So that said, one particular pattern of feeding refusal where kids are, you know, willing to eat a wide variety of foods, but they are really avoiding meats, that is always an interesting flag to me. If they can eat complex foods like fibrous vegetables and breads and waffles and pancakes, and then when it comes time to eat a hot dog or a piece of steak and they just push it away, or they chew and chew and chew and then spit it out, or they chew, gag, and kind of barf it out, that is always a little bit of a red flag to me. We had some interesting research recently where we looked at all of the esophageal food impactions and in the Intermountain system in kids over about a 3-year span. And 90% of kids that had meat stuck in their esophagus were diagnosed with EoE. So there's something just about the texture and our chew and swallow mechanism of meats that when a kid has EoE, it's just hard to get it down.
Wait, so 90% of kids with meat, they get stuck.
Yes. So if you had meat stuck and you presented to an Intermountain Healthcare emergency department with a pediatric patient, and the reported food was meat, whether it was, you know, steak, chicken, turkey, pork, you know, some other more adventurous meats we had one or two of. But if you had meat stuck and you got an endoscopy that day, or you eventually got an endoscopy, over 90% of those patients ended up being diagnosed with EoE. So meat stuck is a huge flag in my mind. You know, there are others that are more subtle that are just really hard to parse out. Kids can be picky eaters for just a ton of reasons, whether it is, you know, sensory processing, behavioral, just like difficulty with limit setting and, you know, the busy lives we all lead. So simple food refusal in a kid that's otherwise maintaining their weight and is socially well-adjusted and doing well, I don't know that that's a flag for EoE, but if you can tie it to something else like easy gagging or vomiting or low weight or needing a drink with eating or having some other symptoms that localize to the chest, then maybe that should, you know, perk up your antenna a bit more for EoE.
Very helpful. Last question. Are there conditions where a patient may have transient esophageal eosinophilia for another reason? For instance, other things that may cause simple irritation, persistent or cyclic vomiting, food allergies, underlying inflammatory disorders that aren't EoE, et cetera.
Probably / maybe. This is one of those really good questions that sort of is something we're all really interested in, but don't know the answer to. So yeah. I think, you know, we don't do scopes all the time. And it's actually something I really struggle with, that scoping, you know, doing an endoscopy and getting biopsies is such a fixed moment in time, right? What was going on that couple weeks before? Was there a vomiting illness, like an acute gastroenteritis? Was there alfalfa field next to the patient that just got cut right before their endoscopy? I think the answer is yes. There probably are fluctuations in eosinophil counts. There may be certain illnesses that kind of lead to a transient eosinophilia that then goes away and kind of goes back and forth. I think eventually we'll have better non-invasive tracking for EoE and sort of a better proxy for esophageal eosinophilia, and that will be tremendously helpful. I think for now, one thing that we touched on previously is that we not only do we look at the biopsies, we really look at the hallmarks that sort of belie esophageal, you know, chronic inflammation that we see in EoE. And these are those corduroid lines and the white gunk and the, you know, edema and kind of scarring or trachealization. When we see those things, you know, we kind of think that's not a transient process. That's been there for a while. the kind of inflammation has been unchecked. And so I guess that's kind of where the visual hallmarks are really useful in addition to the biopsies. But I think the answer is yes, there's probably a lot of transient eosinophilia. We just haven't found a great way to capture it yet. There's some people are trying all kinds of things. There's one where they have a kid swallow a capsule that's on tied to a string, and then they yank it back out of their mouth to kind of get a brushing of the esophagus. You can imagine how comfortable that is for the child, but it's on the right track of trying to get more frequent esophageal sampling. So it's on our radar.
It does seem that I think that while it feels like we know a lot of things, there is so much we don't know, and so much we don't know about how the body approaches insults, how they're both acute and chronic. And I think every time we think we got it all figured out, we realize that there's a whole new horizon.
Yeah, I think EOE patients exemplify that this is better than it was 20 years ago, where no one even knew really what this was. And when you got this, no one really knew how to treat it. Now we have, you know, really good diagnostics and really good treatments. I think there's still the two major hurdles, which is non-invasive diagnosis and tracking, and then individual patient trigger identification. Like once we can clear those two hurdles in EOE, I think it's really going to be a decent disease to manage.
I really appreciate what you've told us the last couple of weeks, because I think just getting it on my radar makes it much more likely that I'm going to identify these kids and get them to you.
Yeah.
All right.
My pleasure.
Well, thanks so much for your time. Thanks for your expertise. And GI Jake, I hope we can talk again soon.
I would love it. It's been my pleasure to talk with you. And thank you for all that you do. We really enjoy listening.
Thank you very much. Thanks again for listening. Please tell your friends all about us, because it's always nice to find a new audience. For those of you who have questions, send your questions to questionsvcurb.com. And we'll talk to you next week.
Thanks for joining us. We look forward to getting together again next time. The Virtual Curbside is available on iTunes or wherever you find your other favorite podcasts. Be sure to like us and subscribe. We want you to like us both because we're needy that way and because that will help other listeners like you find us. Check out our website, vcurb.com, for supporting materials, schedules, and other great stuff. The Virtual Curbside is an educational production of the Utah chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics. The opinions expressed in this podcast, while carefully considered, are ultimately the opinions of the presenters and not necessarily of the American Academy of Pediatrics or our employers. And remember, the content of this podcast shouldn't be seen as a substitute for seeking actual personal medical care. If this is an emergency, hang up and dial 911. Otherwise, schedule a visit with a caring healthcare provider to try to get to the bottom of your concerns. None of this could happen without Elisa Stoddard, our extraordinary executive director of the Utah AAP. Many thanks to Tim Cosgrove for his help on the website and logo design. Production design and editing thanks to Phil Workus, who also composed the theme music. See you next time.